We couldn't be more excited to announce that the 1st and 2nd of February 2025 are the dates for the upcoming Deep Dive virtual retreat, which has reverted back to a weekend format so that we can accommodate as many of our listeners across the world as possible. Now, if you love the breakout room sessions and workshops from this year's 10-week Deep Dive, don't worry. We'll still be including sessions like those before and after the two-day intensive. Plus, this year we're focusing on giving you access to more gatekeepers. So, besides a few awesome author presentations, expect to hear from a lot more incredible agents and editors. This lineup is spectacular. We can't wait to start sharing it with you. Mark the dates in your calendar, especially the date for the early bird pricing, which will happen on the 29th of November. You definitely don't want to miss that. Follow us on Instagram and subscribe to our newsletter for more details. We hope to see you there.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. I am so excited to share that I am teaching my super popular Hacking Writing on a Line Level class in November. And this time, it's a three-day event. We'll spend the first 2 days learning rules and techniques that will help you elevate your writing. And then the third day will be dedicated for Q&A. This class is filled with examples, and I mean it, all examples all the time. So you will leave with an invaluable toolkit to hack your own writing on a line level. Check out the link in my bio on Instagram for more information. I hope to see you there.
Hey, I'm Brooke. My friends and I perform spooky stories on our podcast, 13. 13 is a movie for your ears with immersive sound design and music from our composer. And we're not reading you the same old ghost stories from Reddit. With original stories from our in-house writers and submissions from up-and-coming authors, 13 will make you smile, break your heart, and have you wishing for a nightlight. Atmospheric, slow burn, always spooky, and sometimes sexy. Our friends are some of the best voice actors and writers in our little corner of the podcast industry.
So if you want to find out why those figures in black keep meeting by the water just before dawn, why you should never sleep in a room with an empty chair, or why you hear faint music echoing from the abandoned mall,
join us by following 13 wherever you're listening right now. That's 13, the word, not the number, all spelled out.
Bridget Howard keeps asking for my teeth.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. We'll be taking a break from recording new Books with Hooks segments over the summer so that we can recharge our batteries and return fully energized in the fall. We'll still be critiquing two new Books with Hooks submissions each week, though, which our paid Substack subscribers will get every Tuesday through our newsletter. That's until we return with new segments to air in the fall. So continue to submit your queries to us through our website. In the meantime, we'll be kicking it back by playing Books with Hooks episodes from our backlist while still airing brand new author interviews each week. Hi, everyone. Welcome to our Books with Hooks segment. We are going to dive straight in. Cece, why don't you read our first query letter?
Dear Ms. Waters and Ms. Lira, I enjoyed speaking with both of you during the Festival of Literary Diversity and find your advice incredibly helpful. Thank you for taking the time to critique query letters and first pages on the Shit No One Tells You About Writing podcast. The Rishta is an Own Voices adult contemporary novel that will appeal to lovers of Fatma Farin, Misra's A Place for Us, and Uzma Jalaluddin's Aisha at Last. The full manuscript is approximately 80,000 words. It is a standalone novel with series potential. Please note that
novel includes mention of Shia genocide, which can be triggering. 23-year-old Azia Talpour does not fit the mold of the perfect Pakistani daughter. She doesn't know how to behave in public. She watches too much basketball. Her bedroom is always a mess. And she wants to enter the publishing industry when she graduates from college. Oh yeah, and she just got dumped by her secret boyfriend. When Adam Anwar, a man she's never met before, uses her surreptitious past to blackmail her into accepting his rishta, marriage proposal, Azia has no choice but to play along. In order to keep her ex-boyfriend hidden, escape her engagement, and follow her dream of becoming an editor, rather than pursuing the steady business career selected for her, she must risk breaking her immigrant parents' hearts. With the help of her blackmailer's alienated siblings, Azia has to reconcile the future she wants and the life her parents have outlined for her before she's trapped in a false marriage. As a Pakistani-American Muslim woman, I have drawn on my experiences with my family and our adjustment to a Western lifestyle in San Francisco, California. As a writer, I have attended Women in Publishing Summit, DVCon, Write Hive Conference, Festival of Literary Diversity, and Literary Cleveland's Incubator. I am a member of Megan February's Book Year Program. Sincerely, Narjeez Sheikh.
Awesome. Thanks, Cece. Okay, Carly, why don't we hand it across to you? Why don't you let us know what you think of this query letter?
Naturally, I thought this was great. I thought, you know, there was so much going on here with the hashtag Own Voices. The manuscript word count is on point, and the little trigger warning was really thoughtful and generous, and that was very welcome. I thought that one thing that I wasn't really clear about was whether this was more commercial or literary, because I feel like the A Place for Us is a bit more literary, and then Ayesha at Last is a bit more commercial. So I think I would have just wanted to know a little bit more about where exactly that is in the marketplace, because it said this is an Own Voices adult contemporary novel, but it doesn't say upmarket, commercial, et cetera, et cetera. So those, I feel like those were great comps, but I also felt like I wasn't exactly sure whether I should be thinking commercial or literary. But author bio was great. All of that was good. One thing I wanted to talk about, and Cece, you know, let me know if you want to go here, but I want to talk a little bit about when agents don't win projects that we offer on. So I won't say which of these comp titles I offered on, because I don't want to single out the author or anything like that, but one of these projects in the comp I offered rep on. And so it's always amusing to me when I see those comps in pitches, because, you know, I've read that book, I've considered that book, and I've offered on that book. Yeah, and it has a special little place in my heart. So, you know, there's a lot of heartbreak that goes into when we offer rep on things. And when I see projects that I offered rep on as comps, it also lets me know, like, this is obviously a project that I would probably be seriously interested in as well. And it's a little bit of an internal chuckle. Yeah. So it's one of those things where agents get heartbroken too. And I like to remind everybody of that. You know, we don't win every single project we offer rep on. And a lot of times, mostly out of confidentiality, you know, agents don't talk about that sort of thing because, you know, out of respect to the authors and things like that. And not getting in the way of their future careers or anything like that. But we offer rep and lose projects all the time. Another one happened to me this week. So just letting everybody know that agents do also understand the heartbreak of the query process. It's also really challenging for us as agents because we don't have anything to offer financially, right? Like with an editor, you know, you can go to auction when we're selling a book, but with agents, like all we offer is, you know, our personality and our track record and our sales and our agency. We have to go through this pageantry. In the industry, we often call it the beauty contest. It's this pageantry of, you know, trying to woo this client, which is always so, again, amusing and heartbreaking. But Cece, do you want to talk about any of your heartbreaks? You want to go there with me?
Oh, gosh. Yes. Thank you for saying this. I feel like not enough people know about this. It happens quite often. It happens to me all the time. I lost on a project about 2 weeks ago that I was so incredibly excited about. And I got way ahead of myself and almost like started writing the pitch for it because I was just so passionate about the work. It's happened many times in my short agenting career. And I understand. And you know what? I'll also say this. For me, I've only been doing this for a couple of years. It's both refreshing, but at the same time, disheartening to hear that it still happens to, you know, someone like you, Carly, because you've been doing it for 11 years, right? I thought, okay, it's because I'm a new agent, but you know, pretty soon this won't happen anymore. And when we started working together, I found out that nope, it still happens, even though, and I'm like, okay, well, I guess I have that to continuously look forward to. You know, Carly, already mentioned in a previous episode, but there is a power imbalance between agents and authors, particularly in the beginning of the relationship. And oftentimes the power is with the agent, or it feels like it is anyway. And that's not something we want, but it's, you know, it's the reality, it's the perceived reality anyway. And when a writer has more than one offer of representation, it's a moment where the author has that power, and it is as it should be. It is always a wonderful, wonderful thing to know that an author has tons of options. That does not mean that it makes our heartbreak hurt any less. I keep up with the authors who I offered rep from. I follow them on social media. Some of them, there's a book that is actually coming out in December of this year that I offered rep on. And she and I both follow each other on social media, and I promote her book, and she always thanks me. And we sometimes DM, and it, you know, it became a friendship, because at the end of the day, that's all that matters, right? The book is getting made, and I'm happy for it. But this is a very good point. Rejection happens to everyone in the publishing industry. Agent, writer, editor. I wonder if publicists get rejected. Maybe that's what
their pitches.
Have done.
Their pitches get rejected sometimes.
Right, there you go. So rejection is for everyone.
Yeah. What I like to remind people is that, as it, you know, agents that are listening to this, is that it means you're getting good submissions. Like, it means that you are in that kind of category of agent that is, you know, you're getting really great projects. You know, it might be competitive situations with other great agents. And a lot of times we compete with the same agents who end up becoming our friends because we all have the same taste. So it's kind of this, you know, ironic, circuitous relationship. Another thing, what Cece was saying about becoming friends with people that you offered rep on. I have somebody like that where I offered rep. She ended up getting tons of offers. The book was a huge success, but her and I still DM. And it's great because, you know, what if I, you know, need a blurb someday? You know, I could think of like her, and we still have that great relationship. So it's just one of those things where, again, any agents listening to this, I don't think anybody would do this, but, you know, if somebody says, you know, I'm going with another agent, you know, thank you for your time, I always, you know, send them best regards. You know, I can't wait to see this book on the shelf. You know, I'm so excited for you. You know, sad for me, excited for you is what I basically always say, because I am, you know, it's, you never, and you also never know when somebody's going to come back. I had another example where this person chose another agent. It didn't work out, and they came knocking on my door again, and they said, you know, does your offer still stand, right?
Did it still stand?
Okay. Yes, it still stands. Yeah. And so they came back, right? You know, I'm going to be doing this forever. And careers are long, long things. Writers, successful writers' careers are going to be long too. So we never know how we're going to cross paths at conferences and things like that. So just reminding everybody, yeah, we all have the heartbreak, and it's a super small world.
And it's actually happened to Carly and I, because when I was at a different agency, we both got pitched at a writer's conference, the same project, and we both loved it. And the writer, when we were both already at PS and couldn't send the manuscript to both of us because that's just not how it works, the writer chose Carly. And I think she chose really well because, yeah, she's my colleague and she's awesome. And at the end of the day, as long as you pick a good agent, it's all good.
Listen, I'm just like, this is great, all this kumbaya stuff. But what I find much more interesting is, forget about you send that agent a congratulations. Let's do what Roxane Gay does, and let's have a nemesis in publishing, and let's tweet dark.
I have some nemesis.
Good.
I have some nemesis. Don't you worry. I can't go on the nemesis tirade on a podcast because this is public, but you know, when we get offline, everybody who's listening, we'll be sharing nemesis. Don't you worry.
Oh, I can't wait. I'm busy rubbing my hands together like a villain in some old time movie. But yeah, because that would make a really good book. This agent and this agent who are nemesis, and they're fighting for one really good client. So you get the writing in there and everything, and lots of conflict, which is what we all want. Okay, so we have gone a bit off track. Cece, would you like to come back to the query letter? What notes did you have on there?
Yes, let's do it. So I love the shout out to the Festival of Literary Diversity. Thank you for that. Shout out to The Fold for the great work. Small thing, Carly has mentioned this before, and I very much agree. If you put the titles in all caps, it really helps with readability. I know it might seem like the smallest thing in the world, but it does help. I wanted to know where this was taking place. And I imagine it might be San Francisco because of the author bio paragraph, but I wasn't sure. And I just wanted to know. So I have a question. In the plot paragraph, is it intentional that her surreptitious past is kept so vague? Because it's used to blackmail her, right? And a good commercial novel has the character under a lot of pressure. And being blackmailed is a great way to like put the pressure on the character. But then I need to understand a little bit more about that secret, unless there's some reason why we can't know. I always feel like it's a fine line to toe, how much you share, how much you don't. But I feel like we should probably know what the surreptitious past is. I just want to understand the magnitude, I guess, to have a sense of the stakes. Are we talking about something that could land her in jail? Or are we talking about something that could disappoint her parents?
I thought it was almost the secret relationship, right?
That's already at stake, though, with her intentions to go to publishing, right? Because if she's going to disappoint her parents, like, don't get me wrong, I know that disappointing your parents is a huge, huge, huge deal. And there are cultural implications here, but I don't know. Is it enough? Is that what it is, that she had a relationship? Because if she's already going to leave her life and go into publishing, she's already going to disappoint them. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into this. And also, if he's an ex, why does she have to keep him hidden? But then I guess maybe that might make sense because, you know, if she still had the relationship.
There's questions. So that's the thing, is that those questions need to be answered in the query letter.
I would have kept on reading. If this person had queried me, I would have kept on reading and I would have hoped that the pages would have given me clarity. We do request the first 10 pages right on the body of the email. And this is helpful. And I wanted to say, thank you so much. Very cool that you added your social media handles at the end of this. It's super helpful. I so appreciate it. It's not mandatory. You don't have to if you don't want to, but I love it. So thank you so much.
Okay, Carly, why don't we dive into those first pages? What did you think of them?
So one of my questions, as I kind of mentioned with the query, was, is this commercial or is this literary? So I'm going into this kind of opening section trying to feel my way through what is the category. And the careful selection of word choice, really kind of being in the moment in this scene, made me think it's a little bit more literary. So I was kind of like, okay, I think this might be like an upmarket novel is kind of where I landed with this. And so what happens, just for the listener, is that the character is saying, you know, I'm going to marry Raza Jaffrey. So she says, you know, he's fulfilled close to nothing on my husband checklist. I knew this when he approached me at the university library. So little things like this, where I'm like, okay, you know, there's really wonderful, careful word choice. This is a great opening. So I'm thinking, yeah, this is an upmarket novel. And so we're meeting this main character in Raza, who she thinks she's going to marry. But what happens is this kind of blows up in her face, because she wants him to kind of organize his family together, come over to the house, make a marriage proposal. And he basically says, no, I'm not doing that. And kind of embarrasses her and says, you know, I believe I'm of higher class than you, therefore that won't be happening. And no, that's embarrassing that you thought that. So my big question for this section is, the partner that somebody chooses says a lot about that person. And so clearly this is a shitty dude. And that's fine. It's okay to have shitty dude characters. But the fact that this character was so blind to how crappy this guy was tells me a lot kind of about this female character. And so I'm confused about her, because when somebody chooses a shitty person, even if it's a friend that chooses a really crappy partner, you're thinking like, that says a lot about your friend, right? You're like, man, like, you're better than that. Like, why'd you choose this person? So I think about what this is actually saying about our main character, because we know this guy kind of, you know, they're dumping each other, you know, they're moving on. This isn't the guy. But I'm concerned that I don't really know why she chose this person. So this isn't necessarily like a likable versus unlikable person. I'm just trying to figure out through the lens of this character why she chose him. And if she was so naive that she couldn't figure, like, she couldn't see this guy for who she was, I feel like I need to understand a little bit more of that. And it is first person. So yeah, so she should have this revelation of like, oh, like, I'm so naive, I didn't even understand. But she comes off with a bit of rage. So I just felt a disconnect of what the author was trying to do with this relationship and what they were trying to tell us about this character in a way that I think, I, again, very interesting. This is an awesome place to start. And I think this is the right place to start, but I would have just liked to know a little bit more about this match and why this character thought this was a good match. So that was kind of my main note that kind of carried through the whole thing. The second part of the sample is the character going home and kind of feeling like she has a big secret that she can't tell her family about this love interest. So there's a lot of great drama, a lot of stakes here.
Cece, just before I move across to you, something that I know emerging writers do is they try, in terms of showing the character arc, because remember, who your character is at the end of the novel needs to be very different to who they are at the beginning of the novel, or else we like, why did they go on this journey? Why have we had to be with them? And sometimes, you know, emerging writers will show characters behaving either in shitty ways in the beginning or behaving in ways that don't really make sense, so that they can show later on how much the character has learned and grown. But the reader still needs to be able to get on board with the mistakes that they're making and understand why they're making those kind of mistakes as they go through the whole character arc later on. Cece, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, I think Carly hit the nail on the head when she said that this is not about being likable or unlikable. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with us understanding and falling in love with this person, with her, essentially, right? And it makes so much sense, because my first note as I was reading this on the margins after the first full paragraph, and, you know, for the listener, the first full paragraph says that he fulfilled close to nothing on my husband checklist. I knew this when he approached me at the university library. February. I knew this when I told him to leave me alone. And I knew this when he smoothly navigated around my pragmatic defenses, enchanting me senselessly. The next paragraph does not explain why what about him made her fall in love with him. And that was my question. I wrote down when she said enchanting me senselessly, I wrote down with his dot, dot, dot. Like I wanted to understand, A, what about him didn't fulfill your checklist? So what is your checklist? Because I still don't know. And B, what about him made you make all these exceptions, I guess, because he's so great. Like, for example, and I don't mean that you have to like give me a full paragraph, like small things like his sense of humor, the fact that you guys love the same music, the fact that you can talk to him about your parents and that he doesn't judge you. I don't know, whatever it is. I need to feel that with a lot of specificity. This is the trick here, right? It has to be incredibly specific to you because in real life, that's what happens. We fall in love with someone for incredibly specific reasons that say a lot about who we are and about where we are in life. I want to say there's a lot of really great detail here, like the hot chocolate that was warming her hands. There's a part where she mentions Citadel of Rules about, you know, the way her parents have enveloped her in rules. And it's just so good, right? Like there's a lot here that's working. So as I was reading this, he becomes this totally different person and says, I'm never going to marry you. Like you're beneath me. It's ridiculous that you even thought that you had a chance with me, essentially. It's like a Jekyll and Mr. Hyde situation here, right? Like he becomes someone else. So I have two theories. Either one, he does love her and he's just pretending that he became this horrible person because for some reason he's under a lot of pressure from his family or whatever. I mean, I'm wondering if the author wanted us to think this. Or two, she was duped, which is totally okay because we've all been there, right? Like we've all been misled and fooled. You know, I just need more emotional context so that I could have a firm theory. And right now, because I know very little about her, it could honestly be both of these things. And I would like to have like a strong opinion one way or another.
You don't think the author was going for kind of a Mr. Darcy, Eliza Bennett kind of thing in terms of class differences and this man saying that he wouldn't marry this woman because she's beneath him? Maybe there's a redemptive thing later where he comes back and realizes that he was wrong.
But then why is he with her?
Yeah, the Mr. Darcy thing is like they're so apart and in that society they can't actually interact. But they spent months together. Like if you spend months with somebody, and the thing that I can't quite figure out is like, were they intimate with each other? Not that it matters, but like how close was this relationship?
I don't think so because she said he never crossed a boundary. Although that might have been a different kind of boundary, right? But I also had that question.
Yeah, because if you spend like, you could fall in love with somebody in 3 months, you know, or, you know, a month, you know, if you're spending all of this time together, like really connecting and really vibing. And that's why this whole like, flip the switch thing. I don't know. Yeah, I feel like
if he had used her sexually, then, you know, this manic switch thing might even make sense because he could be like a really, really big jerk, horrible person, abuser. But then if he was so respectful of her in every way and wonderful in every way and all of a sudden switched, I need more is what I'm saying.
I would just say like, I really like this. I think sometimes when Cece and I go on and on and on about something, maybe it's like, we have a lot of critiques for it. Usually we go on and on and on about the things that we think have a lot of potential. So yeah, we're saying there's a lot of potential here. It starts in the right place. So brava.
Awesome. Wonderful. Okay. Carly, would you like to read the second query letter for us?
Dear Carly and Cecilia, I am seeking representation of my novel to potential publishers and appreciate you taking the time through the Shit No One Tells You About Writing podcast to critique my query letter and the first 5 pages of my novel. More Than I Ever Had is a historical adventure story of 103,000 words based on the life of my family ancestor, Theophilus Futrell. The story is told from the unique perspective of a New South Wales Corps soldier and will appeal to readers of historical fiction, particularly those who enjoy Kate Grenville's The Secret River, The Lieutenant, and Sarah Thornhill, and Peter Fitzsimmons' James Cook. It's the year 1790. Desperately out of work with limited options, Theo Futrell enlists as a young soldier in the New South Wales Corps. Daunted, he sails away from England to the new penal settlement on the other side of the world. Amidst famine and hardship in Sydney, Theo finds love in the shape of a beautiful convict nurse, Ellen Short. Determined to be promoted and gain land, Theo makes a decision that puts him in the middle of civil and military tensions and jeopardizes his life. With the help of an influential ally, John MacArthur, Theo's freedom is assured, but his dream of a family is shattered when he finds himself as a single father to his son, Joseph. Bereft, Theo struggles to be a good father. When he reconnects with the street-smart but married convict, Anne Gilbert, fate allows him a second chance at family. But after Theo receives new military orders, he must choose between his son and his new family. Can he survive the consequences of his decision, leading to his most heartbreaking loss of all? The story is based on the life of Theophilus Futrelle, who arrived in Australia on the notorious Second Fleet as a New South Wales Corps soldier. The tale of love, loss, survival, and a father's commitment to a son. I have worked in communications as a copywriter and editor in the corporate and science environments in Australia. I completed the Australian Writers' Centre's Creative Writing Stage 1 program and a 6-month membership with the UK-based History's Quill Work in Progress Group Coaching. I'm a member of the North Beaches Writers Group and have lived in Melbourne, Adelaide, and London, and now call Sydney my home. This is my first novel. I look forward to receiving your critique of this query letter and the first 5 pages of my manuscript. Kind regards, redacted.
I would just like to say that as a South African who hosts this podcast, I will set aside the animosity we usually feel towards Australians so that we can continue with this query letter. Our rugby sides are constantly competing against each other, and our cricket teams are constantly competing against each other as well. Plus, we have running commentary on who has more dangerous insects and reptiles in their country. But I will put that aside as we move on to this. Cece, would you like to tell us what you think of that query letter?
Yes, and I thought that was very amusing. I liked that. I didn't know there was a rivalry. Okay, we always talk about how like word count is really important, and this is 103,000 words. I will say, though, that because it's historical fiction, that's okay. It's not too long. I'm saying this because oftentimes I tell people, try to keep it at 99,000 max because people can't stand anything over 100K. So I think it's fine because of the genre. Second paragraph, the writer offers two, and I'm using air quotes in between two, comps. Kate Greenville's, and then there are 3 titles, and then another book. You don't need 3 titles by Kate Greenville. Pick one. Only because, like, first of all, you don't need to list 3. It's extra information. It adds words to your letter, but also because you're not really telling us anything new. I'm not familiar with Kate Greenville's novels, but, you know, if someone tells me that their work is similar to Ellen Hildebrand's The Rumor, I know, because I know her body of work, that probably this means that it has also a lot in common with her other titles, since, you know, she has a strong author brand. So I really would pick one. I think that's important. The one that is most consistent with your work. And then paragraphs 4 and 5, 2 things. One, there's a lot of detail. It's almost like the author is giving us a beat by beat of the story, which I understand why this person's doing this, because he wants to convey the plot, but it's like too much information. So I would dial it back. It feels like there's 2 plots, which can be confusing. It feels like there's 2 heroes' journey inside one story. Is that intentional? Maybe it is. But if it is, it does fall out a little bit of the conventions, which is okay as long as it's intentional. But it's also possible that it's not intentional and that it's a really common mistake made in historical fiction inspired by family members. Usually there's so much ground to cover. And then, you know, what you do is you just say everything that happened to this person without tying it together. There has to be a through line. So for example here, and I don't know this person's story, it could be something like Theo has always dreamed of having a family in his first attempt, and then the first plot point, which doesn't work out. He has a second chance at this when he meets, and then that plot point. And again, I don't know if that's actually the guiding question, but that is really what you have to do. Figure out what the guiding question is in your work. And that is the question that the reader is seeking to answer right from the moment of the inciting incident. There are many questions the reader is seeking to answer, but there is one that the reader is turning the pages consistently because they can't wait to find out. Will she this? Will he this? Will they this? And I think that needs to be woven in a bit more tightly. And I totally get the challenge. It's like a huge challenge, but it does have to be done.
Wonderful. Thanks, Cece. Carly, what did you think?
Yeah, I was, my main note was going to be the same thing what Cece was saying about it's so hard when you have a real life story, turning it into fiction, especially respecting family's wishes. Oftentimes, I'm not saying this is the case here, but oftentimes the writer feels like their family story is the most important story to ever exist. And so they do kind of go over the top with specificity. I think this author is actually doing a great job of focusing on all of the high points, you know, the actual drama and the actual plot. So I think there is actual plot here. So that's why I'm saying I think this person has what it takes. The only thing I would say, you know, in the second paragraph, it says the story is told from a unique perspective of a New South Wales Corps soldier. You know, they keep focusing on like why this story is unique without kind of telling you why it's unique in a hook. So I would say, tell us what is unique about this. Not like everybody kind of knows about the migration from England to Australia area, you know, New Zealand and everything like that in terms of the convicts, but what is specifically unique about this? And I think we really have to focus on that. I would find a way to combine the paragraphs amidst famine and then the next one bereft Theo struggles, I would figure out a way to combine those two, use less names, figure out a way to just kind of tailor that a little bit more, pull that down so it's not so wordy. But yeah, I think there's a lot of drama here. I think there's a lot to work with. It's very strong, but I do think I agree with Cece as well. Pick one of Kate Granville's books. But yeah, this is very interesting. And I don't normally work on historicals that are this historical, but I'm intrigued by all the drama here.
Wonderful. Thanks, Carly. Cece, why don't we dive into those opening pages? What did you think of those?
Okay, this was a challenge for me personally. For the listener, here's what happens. Theo is working at a factory. We know, because the author does a really good job of inserting this, that he works at a factory 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. And the factory catches on fire. And then what we see is Theo and, you know, people around him struggle to get out of the fire, but also save people and, you know, try to put the fire out. It's very well written, very clear. I know exactly what was happening. I was always in scene. There is emotion. I wondered if the emotion could be woven into it a bit more seamlessly, as opposed to just having like a paragraph with the emotion, because that's what's happening right now. But even then, like that, it wasn't an issue at all. Like, it was really, really well done. What I'm saying it's a challenge is because I got to the end of this and I was like, what? There's something that's not working here. And I didn't know what it was. There was an emotional shift from the beginning to the end, because Theo does immediately realize that without the factory, he has no livelihood. He's an orphan. He has no one to turn to. His best friend, or his friend anyway, at least has a wife and has like a father-in-law that can help, I think. And he has no one. And, you know, what is he going to do? He has no livelihood. So I was thinking, like, what's wrong with this? It's well written, but there's something. And I had to take some time to think about it. And that's because I couldn't pinpoint what it was. And it happens to me a lot where I feel things before I'm able to articulate them, but I'm absolutely sure of the feeling. And after a while, I realized, and it was so simple. Right now, the first pages are Theo is in the factory, factory catches on fire. Theo immediately, and very full of lots of awareness, realizes that he has no livelihood. He has no place to go. And he has to, you know, he goes to a different place. That's why he migrates. Picking an inciting incident isn't just about choosing something in a character's life that, if it were happening in real life, would constitute significant stakes. Because yes, in real life, if a factory catches on fire, I'm an orphan, it's all I have, that is a high stakes problem. No doubt about it. In fiction, it's not. In my opinion, you need to really put your main character in a pressure cooker situation, because fiction is a representation of heightened reality. And I'll illustrate what I mean by this with an example that probably does not apply here, but, you know, just to give the author a sense of what I mean. If Theo had gambling debts, perhaps not even his gambling debts left by someone else, I don't know, but let's say it's his. And that's why he needed to work 12 hours a week, or one of the reasons, right? Like, and with the factory burning, it's not only that he won't have money for basic things, which is, like, again, in real life is a very real problem, but also these people are going to come after him and going to potentially kill him. If he had just been left by the woman of his dreams, or if maybe losing the factory meant that the woman left him, I don't know. I would like more drama, more subplots surrounding this inciting incident to heiten the stakes. And it's strange to say this, because anyone would agree that if you lose your livelihood, that's enough stakes in real life, but I don't think it's enough in fiction. So that's my note for the author. I know this is based on your ancestor's life, but that's okay, because this is historical fiction. You get to make stuff up. I would just weave in more drama, not in a like gratuitous way. Like, I would really just think, how can I put pressure on this character from all sides? Like, just really heighten it up. And that would mean that him migrating to a different place would carry that much more significance. There could be people chasing him. He could be fleeing from a broken heart. I don't know.
Carly, what did you think of those opening pages?
Yeah, I was just kind of nodding along. I think kind of what you're getting at here is that historical, like, this historical time period is so full of drama, right? Like, we are so privileged in our life with our science and our medicine and our technology. Like, living in this time period, anything could trip you up. You know, there were, you know, the chance of getting murdered, you know, going broke, getting a disease that's going to kill you. Like, there are, like, I think that's kind of what you're getting at, is that you can layer so much drama into historical fiction, because there was a lot of things happening that could potentially, you know, do damage to you, again, like your livelihood. So definitely agree with you there. My thing was, I agree, there was like something just a little bit off or missing. I thought that, oh, this was a very exciting and palpable opening scene. Very, very, very good. The thing that I would have liked was for us to have this fire scene, again, be in the moment, do all of that. But then on the page, go back to the boarding house. And instead of doing all that info dump with the explaining the backstory, get us right from the fire scene. He walks back to the boarding house. And then we get all this stuff through dialogue about his past and his history, because, you know, we're so in the moment with this fire scene, which is great, right? Very dramatic, but there's not a lot of dialogue because they're like trying to save, you know, other people's houses and save the factory. Obviously the factory is not saved, but that would have been, you know, right from one to the next for me, that would have accomplished dramatic scene, then get into dialogue to explain the backstory. So that's my big note, but there's a lot happening here, a lot of potential.
Awesome. Thanks, Carly. We are going to take some of the questions that you've all sent to us in terms of Q&As, things you want to ask agents. Before we do, there is something I've been wanting to ask Carly since I finished finally watching Mayor of Easttown, because Carly was like, you have to watch it, you have to watch it. And she was obsessed with it. And I came back to this thing that Carly always says in terms of the query letters, in terms of the kind of fiction that she is pitched. And Carly will go, where is the warm, kind of fuzzy, redemptive moment at the end of this, that, you know, they go through all these terrible things, but here is this shining moment at the end. Carly, where the hell was that on Mayor of Easttown? Where was our warm fuzzy? For those of you who haven't watched the end, this is going to be spoilers. So for those of you who haven't watched it yet, maybe just fast forward. Okay, Carly, yes.
For me, the redemptive part is setting us up for season two. You know what I mean? Like, there was the love interest between the writer and Mayor. I actually thought the writer was a total red herring. This is turning into like a gossip podcast about Mayor of Easttown, but I thought that the writer was a red herring, because I thought, okay, this dude won a National Book Award 20 years ago. Somehow he's still getting jobs teaching at colleges around the state. There's so many more recent relevant writers. So why does this guy keep getting jobs? And then I thought, oh, all of these young women like this dude. And no, maybe I thought he was wrapped up in the murder. But anyway, yeah. So I think there was the romance. Okay, Cece has a note here. Go ahead, Cece.
Definitely there's an uplifting arc, which is that in the end, even though that horrible thing happened and, you know, spoilers, a child goes to jail. Nobody wants that. That's horrible. And the point, though, is that even with that horrible, horrible thing, Mayor and Laura come together as friends. The female friendship is there.
I didn't buy that though. I did not buy that. I'm sorry. If my best friend sends my child to prison.
Your best friend didn't send the child.
Did you see her near the knife? Did you see her near the knife block?
I don't remember that. It was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I was like, she's going to get the knife.
I thought that too. But they came together, female friendship, yes. Women supporting women. There's an arc there, guys.
This is what I think is the redemptive story of this show. you know what I think it is? It's therapy. Therapy, right? Mayor starts off hating therapy and at the end willingly goes to therapy.
That is a good redemptive arc.
It is therapy.
So it's self-knowledge, self-acceptance, her dealing with all of these demons. For me, the redemptive arc was her climbing up into the attic.
But I don't know that that was enough.
And really, if that was my best friend and my kid, like, I don't know. But I absolutely loved the show. It was amazing. I was just sitting there going, where is Carly's redemptive arc?
Therapy wins.
Right. Well, there we go. There we go. In your books, put somebody in therapy. Okay. So let's take, we've got 10 minutes to take some questions. I'm going to hit them out at you guys and you can alternate in terms of answering them. Here we go. Okay. How much personality versus professionalism should you have in a query letter?
I say always err on the side of professionalism, because everybody's idea of personality is different. Some people think they're funny. They're not so funny. So when in doubt, always err on the side of professionalism. The personality can come through in two places. The author bio. You know, you could do something very small and cute there if you want to say, you know, so-and-so, you know, lives in Seattle with their lovingly obese cat or something like that. Like being really like, you could be cutesy there.
Yeah, good. All right. Next one. Is it of absolute necessity to approach an agent only after the manuscript is professionally edited by an editor? Cece?
What I would say is that it is of absolute necessity to approach an agent only after the manuscript is as amazing as you can make it. different people have different resources, and let's not pretend like things like money don't matter, because sometimes they do. If you can hire a great editor, that could be really helpful. It might cut back on time that you would otherwise spend on self-editing, but it is by no means necessary to hire an editor. I know of many, many, many talented authors, some of them my clients, who have never hired an editor in their lives. They've relied on critique partners, beta readers, and more importantly, self-editing. Put your manuscript away and come back to it with a self-editor hat. But of course, different people have different ways to achieve their end result. And if you want to hire an editor, that's fine. But the idea to keep in mind is your manuscript must be as wonderful as possible, because competition for this is fierce.
Carly, do you also reject on word count? If so, what are the parameters by genre?
I don't auto reject. I feel that it's a red flag for me for sure. I don't do kid lit like very often. So I know there's very specific, like how long a middle grade is and things like that. For adults, anything that I am looking for is generally in the 75,000 words being on the shorter side. But if it's tight and punchy, that's fine. On the longer side, I generally don't work on any fiction over 100,000 words, because I don't do any sort of science fiction fantasy world building. Any historicals might push 100, but that's not usually my space. So when in doubt, you know, 75 to 100 should be everybody's sweet spot. I'd go with that.
Wonderful. Thank you. Cece, if you have an underlying theme or agenda with your novel, is it important to include that in the query, even if it bumps up the word count? Additionally, is there a perfect word count for query letters, as one page can be fudged with spacing and font, etc.?
I would say in terms of the ideal word count, 300 to 500 words, or something in that range. It is very subjective though. I think when in doubt, err on the side of brevity. In terms of the themes, so I would say no, don't include it in the query letter if it's going to bump up your word count. And here's why. The themes should be apparent through the plot. You don't have to spell this out for the agent. The agent is really smart, I promise. For example, a book like Thin Girls by Diana Clark. If I read the pitch copy for that, I don't know because I haven't done it in a while, but I've read the book. I doubt that the themes will be spelled out. Like, this book covers themes of, that probably won't be there, but based on the plot, I can tell. So the plot should really do the heavy lifting. And it's okay to add that sentence as long as you're not going to bump up the word count.
Awesome. Thank you. Carly, how much weight do agents put on comps in query letters?
Well, it's great this question landed on me, because I'm always the one blathering on comps. I say this every time, and I wish I didn't put that much emphasis on comps, but I really do, because it tells me how much you read in your genre, how well you actually know your book, that self-awareness, how recent, you know, your project might be, how in tune you are with the market. So I wish that I didn't have to, but we work in a business, and comps and business go hand in hand. So I do put a lot of weight on them.
Okay, great. More comps questions, but this one, Cece, is it best to focus on tone, structure, or theme when choosing comp?
Ooh, okay. For me, for my taste, I would say ideally all of them if you can do that, but if you can't, tone, theme, structure, in that order, unless, and this is the exception, there's something really different and experimental about your book. So for example, if the structure is really unique, then you might want to find a comp that has that really unique structure as well and reference that specifically. But you know, if it's more like conventional all across the board, then that would be the order. You know, one thing that I will say is that you can specify in what way something is a comp. You can say something like with the lyrical prose of, and then insert that comp, or with the alternating points of view and timeline in XYZ. That's fine. You can be really specific if you want to be.
Okay. Well, that actually then leads to our next question. So I'll ask you to answer that as well. Do you have tips on identifying relevant comps for stories whose themes and plots are unusual?
Okay. So essentially, this is going to the bookstore. It should be your Disneyland, right? Like, it should be your favorite thing to do. Whether it's on your iPad or Kindle or whatever, your e-reader, or whether it's an actual bookstore, there's usually a shelf that's like, if you like this, you will like that. So have a lot of look at those kinds of books and see how they do it. See how other people find comparable titles in terms of like the reader's taste, right? In bookstores. That's one way. Another way is to look up the comps in the deal announcements. If you follow authors on Twitter and on social media, they often share the announcement for their deals, and they have shared for past deals. And you can see how something, like sometimes you can see how something was pitched. So I believe there was a book called The Other Black Girl that just came out, and I read the arc a few months ago, and it's really good. And I think I remember reading that it was pitched as Get Out Out meets The Devil Wears Prada. And now they've changed the comps, actually. They've changed it to Get Out and something else. But when I first read the arc, those were the comps. So if you look at books that exist and see what comps those books use, that might help inspire you as well. And then also, listen, community. Talk to your friends. Like, you should have a writer's community. If you don't, please find one. It's really important. Writer's group, reader's group, book clubs. Talk about your story. Give people a little bit. And maybe they'll go like, oh my gosh, that reminds me of such and such book. So yeah, that could be helpful as well.
Librarians are a great resource. And also, if you can't find a great comp, you can say, for fans of, you know, XYZ, or my book is in conversation with XYZ. Those are two good segues too.
Awesome. Thank you. Okay. Last question. We'll give this one to Carly. I'd love clarification on when agents would like to be updated in the query process. Any developments at all, or after request for fulls or offers of representation only? There's a lot of conflicting information out there.
Yeah, this is a great question. Traditionally, agents only want to be updated if there's an offer, but I would say any opportunity is kind of an opportunity to nudge. I don't think you need to get in touch if somebody else has just requested the full. You know, I just assume other people are requesting the full because I requested the full. I would say that if you win an award or you're nominated for some, or, you know, you are, you know, some sort of like industry-ish news or an offer, I think those are two cases that you can get in touch.
Wonderful. Okay. So that's been a very jam-packed session. Thank you so much, Carly and Cece, again for taking the time. And we look forward to our next Books with Hooks segment.
Working in a creative industry, I've seen lots of writers and illustrators feel squeamish around money conversations. As a literary agent, I love talking about money, and that's why debunking money conversations are so important. Like, many people think you need loads of money to start investing, or they put off investing because it seems like a later problem. Or creators who deal with art and writing don't have time or passion to research and manage something like investments. That's why I'm thrilled that today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for your future. You don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. Growing up as a young girl who was told she wasn't good at math, investing definitely scared me, but I'm proud to say that I've overcome all those mindset concerns and love talking about investing and how money can be given a chance to grow over time with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/TSNOTYAW or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important information disclosures at acorns.com/TSNOTYAW. My youngest kid just started kindergarten this fall. I can't believe it. And one of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion is not having French as a foundational language myself. And it's worrying because I need to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're younger now, but I see it coming. We live in a bilingual city of 1 million people. We are so lucky to have multilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up at a young age through school and sports and activities. Me, on the other hand, growing up where French wasn't taken so seriously, I'm going to have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone has been coming into my life. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it truly immerses you in the language that you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast-track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio to audio from native speakers, and then gives you feedback on how well you're pronouncing words. You can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages, from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, and even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. It is the best language program to get because they have been the expert in language learning for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. And just in case you were wondering, Rosetta Stone offers 12 more languages than Babbel. Rosetta Stone offers Asian languages, while Babbel does not. Rosetta's offer is a lifetime membership, and no other competitor is offering lifetime memberships. Of all the language apps, Rosetta Stone has the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent built into the program. And as you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how you're pronouncing the words. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy a lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys, 50% off. That's lifetime access to all 25 language courses that Rosetta Stone offers for 50% off. It's a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. Our podcast listeners at The Shit No One Tells You About Writing can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
Today's guest dwells inside her dreams where creativity thrives. As a child, she focused on visual arts, but after 20 years as a graphic designer, all the stories she held captured in her mind clamored to be set free. She put down her tablet and picked up the pen. She went back to school, earning an MFA in creative writing, and began her new life's work, writing the stories of her heart. Today, she is a novelist, writing coach, editor, competition judge, and writing teacher. She particularly enjoys working with emergent writers, often giving them the same pep talks she received years ago. She lives in central Pennsylvania with her husband, three children, and three budgies. The budgies tend to make a racket while she's trying to write, but she is not deterred. It's my pleasure to welcome Abigail Wild. Abigail, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I've been very excited to talk to you.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this discussion because we're not only discussing your book, we're going to be discussing Wild Ink Publishing as well. So we've got a lot of ground that we want to cover today. So for our listeners, before we get into that, I am just going to read the flap copy for you of the book that we're going to start off by discussing. It is called More Than One Way to Breathe. And here is the flap copy at the back. Heartache, betrayal, and abuse. These are Mia's lifelong companions, inflicted upon her by parents who wish she'd never been born. The night she was kicked out of the house, Mia would have frozen to death, if not literally, then emotionally, were it not for the love of her best friend's family. Intuition, love, and wonder. These are Sophie's gifts, unleashed by her struggle with cystic fibrosis and her determination to live fully. When Mia tells Sophie about the long walk down the mountain in the snow, Sophie instinctively knows there is more to the story of Mia's survival. Right. So something that I'd like to discuss with you, Abigail, is why teen readers need to read about tough topics. Because sometimes we get asked, how tough can you go in middle grade, even in YA? Is it too tough for them? What are they able to cope with? So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Sure, absolutely. I do think that we should not discount teenagers and what they can handle, because the reality is many of them are going through so many terrible circumstances, from mental abuse, different sorts of abuse, eating disorders, all sorts of problems. I mean, school shootings, and the kids now are dealing with the 24-hour news cycle on going through TikTok and seeing every terrible injustice that is happening in the world. And they are dealing with all of that. And they are taking that within themselves and trying to learn about how the world works. And so if adults kind of bypass those issues and never address them with the teens, how can a teenager learn to cope with that? How can a teenager learn to grow up and have adult reactions to things if they're never discussed with them to begin with? And because, you know, so often teens are told, well, that's, you're just a teen, you're fine, don't worry about anything. When in reality, you know, I focus on issues that teens are going through, such as More Than One Way to Breathe that you just read the back copy for. The main character, Mia, is going through her best friend, Sophie, dying of cystic fibrosis. Teens do have to deal with things like that. Not only that, but at the same time, Mia is being abused at home. That is a lot for a teenager to deal with. And so what happens so often is these teens feel like they can't speak up. They can't talk to anybody about what they're going through. When in reality, you know, they really are going through it and they need to talk to people. And so I want to write stories that help teens to see and feel that they are not alone in what they are going through, and to not kind of poo-poo what they're going through, but accept it and listen to them. And for me, you know, it's not about record sales or becoming a bestseller. The moment when I knew that I had made the right decision in writing the novels that I'm writing is when a teenager came up to me in a signing and said, you know, this is the first time that I have ever felt seen. And that was everything to me. It made everything worth it.
Oh, yeah. Well, as a writer, that's the best gift a reader can give you, right? Is that they completely connect with your work and they do feel seen. And I think a lot of teens do turn to fiction in terms of a roadmap of how to, you know, endure the things that they are going through, how to solve certain problems that they're having in their lives. So 100% agree with you there. What advice do you have for our listeners who are writing YA and want to write issue-driven stories that are accessible to teenagers?
I think, first of all, it's important to talk to teenagers. You know, you can't be a YA author if you're not spending time with teens, in a safe manner, of course. When I was writing my first novel, The Art of Drowning, which includes topics of head injury, anorexia, bullying at school, things like that, I was working with teenagers. I was in an English classroom. I was working with them on the day-to-day. And these stories came to fruition because I was watching and listening and talking with students about the things that they're going through. And so I think it's important for people to have kind of their pulse on what is going on in the teen world, to pay attention. The other thing is, don't talk down to teens in your writing. Don't simplify it so much that it kind of makes them feel belittled, that it makes them feel infantilized.
Yeah, condescension. I mean, teenagers can pick up condescension, as can middle graders, you know?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. And I think sometimes we don't give them the credit that they are due, that they can read things that are real and raw and understand them and wrestle with them.
Yeah, 100% there. Right. So let's talk about writing disabled characters authentically and sensitively.
Absolutely. When you are dealing with any sort of disability, no matter physical, mental, anything like that, you need to make sure that you have readers that are going through the same thing, early readers, beta readers. Ask questions, do your research. Again, there's nothing worse than, say, having someone who was autistic, and when you write them, you belittle them without even realizing it. And that's why you must have someone within that scope that you're writing in read it and give you advice and be open to that advice.
Yeah, excellent advice in general. You know, I'm a firm believer in sensitivity readers, in authenticity readers, in getting, you know, as much feedback as you can in terms of doing a certain character or a certain experience or a certain, you know, demographic justice. In terms of, you know, appropriation and these kinds of discussions, is it okay for people who are not disabled to write disabled characters so long as they do all of these things, get the authenticity readers, get sensitivity readers, do it with respect, etc.? What's your take on that?
Well, my first novel was, again, about a student who had a head injury. And I wrote that novel because my son had a head injury. And dealing with the school system, dealing with friends who did not understand what he was going through was what prompted me to write this book. I've never had a head injury, but I'm watching with empathy, of course, and a mother's heart. As for the second novel, More Than One Way to Breathe, I was dealing with, of course, cystic fibrosis. And again, tapping back into my past life, one of my best friends from high school had cystic fibrosis, and it was written in honor of her. And so I was able to take what I had experienced in both of these health issues and write about them in a way that can kind of grow understanding. So I think it really comes down to the way in which you approach it, approaching it respectfully. Have you talked to people? Do you have any sort of experience with it? I do think it is fine for people to write, you know, if they do not have ADHD, write that experience, but research enough that you know that you are hitting it right.
Yeah. And when it comes to writing stories with disabled characters as well, I mean, you don't want to always be writing where the disability is the focus of the story, right?
Oh, correct. Absolutely. No, I feel like these moments where the disability is coming to a head, is becoming noticeable, does not need to be the focal point of the story, because people who have disabilities have wider lives beyond their disability. And I think that if people can see beyond the disability, they will know that there is a very full, rich person there begging for you to listen to them, for you to see them. And they have very full lives beyond the disability. And I think that's important for a lot of people to remember, especially, you know, if you can see that someone has a disability, that is not all they are. They are so much more than that. And so I don't really like to make that the focal point.
Yeah, no, I love that, Abigail. Strong agree there. All right, let's talk now a bit about Wild Ink Publishing, because, you know, on the podcast, we tend to focus a lot on sort of traditional routes to publication. A lot of our listeners are focused on getting traditionally published, and they want to be published with the big five most of the time. But we're also seeing a lot of people, especially on Twitter, who have query fatigue, who've been querying for a while, they don't feel like they're getting anywhere, and they're getting frustrated with trying to get an agent, and they're looking at different journeys to publication. And I think it's so important for us as a podcast to say there isn't one right way to publication. There isn't one way that suits everybody. Your temperament, your personality type, your skills, etc., may lend themselves to all different kinds of ways to publish. For example, if you're someone who's really good at marketing and PR, perhaps self-publishing is the way to go for you because you already have skills in that area. So can we talk a bit about what led you to start Wild Ink Publishing and tell us more about it?
Absolutely. I graduated with my MFA in 2019, 2 months before the COVID lockdown. When I was in school for my MFA, I had wanted to become a college professor. And of course, we all know what happened to college campuses during that time. Everything was kicked off of a cliff. So what I started doing with that very much alone time that we were all having is I started to build author communities through Zoom. And so I figure if other authors have somebody to talk to, we'll all feel a little less alone. And so I started a group for teens and I started a group for adults. And we just met once or twice a week and we chatted about writing. From that, we actually put together an anthology called Into the Mirror. And it was basically a look at the inner workings of an author, like what is burning a hole in their heart. And we all wrote short stories, essays, memoirs, poetry. And what I did was I pulled them all together and formulated a book. And I actually started Wild Ink Publishing just to publish this one anthology. I didn't really have plans to go beyond that, but it was important to me to get that one book out because it was so meaningful during the time of the shutdown. So once that came out, some of my friends who are poets came up to me and said, hey, would you publish this book of poetry? I said, yeah, sure. Great. Wonderful. Yes, absolutely. And then suddenly more and more people started coming. And suddenly I had a publishing company. Now, this wasn't too much of a learning curve because I really focused hard on business courses and publishing courses while I was doing my graduate work. I spent a lot of time researching, a lot of time writing papers. You know, so many MFA programs focus on the creative writing, but I wanted to delve into the publishing side. And so that's what I did. So I felt as if I was really prepared to do that. And so now Wild Ink is publishing at least a book a month until 2025. And then we will be doing 2 books a month and we'll see where we go from there.
Wow. Wow. That's quite the journey. And so Wild Ink has got 2 arms. I think one is the sort of traditional indie route and one is for authors who want to self-publish. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. So the traditional side is 100% traditional. Of course, we are indie, so we are small. But what you can get out of a small indie publisher that you trust, because I know there's many out there that are not trustworthy, but that you trust, is that it's a collaboration. It is people working together. Friendships are formed between the editors and the authors. There's so much cheerleading going on. It is absolutely craziness. We have an author Slack where all of the authors come together and chat. We also have a sister publishing company called Conquest Publishing that focuses mostly on romance, erotica, those types of books. And so both sets of authors, Wild Ink and Conquest Publishing, are both together in the Slack. And it is amazing because they are helping each other write, they are helping each other market, they are helping each other grow. And it is an amazing thing that I never expected to happen, but it did. For the self-publishing side, we consider it more self-publishing helps. We don't necessarily publish the self-publishing people. Basically, what they do is come to us and say, hey, you know, I have editing wrapped up, I have marketing wrapped up, but what I don't have wrapped up is a cover. Can you help me design a cover? And so then we quote them what it would cost to get a cover designed. And we design the cover. We go back and forth. I give them 3 to 6 cover concepts to choose from. And then they choose and they pay and they're on their happy way and they go and self-publish. If someone wants just developmental editing, we do just developmental editing. If someone wants some marketing help, we give them marketing help. But we don't necessarily, again, publish the self-publishing people. We actually just aid them in self-publishing because we do. There are so many roads to publishing and we tend to respect them all because there are different reasons why someone would choose self-publishing as opposed to traditional publishing.
Yeah, 100%. And perhaps even people are wanting the traditional route to publication, but they want to polish up the manuscript before they go out on submission to agents, in which case they can come to you for developmental edits or copy edits, etc. as well. Now, something there, Abigail, is I'd love to give our listeners a sense of what these kinds of things cost. Because like I said, I'm seeing more and more on Twitter, people very disillusioned with trying to land agents, with trying to go out, and they're saying, I am going to self-publish. But, you know, when they say this, you get a sense that they haven't quite done their homework yet. They're not quite sure what costs are going to be involved. Because if you are self-publishing, you need to make sure that the manuscript is copy edited, that it is proofread, that it is as polished as it can be. You don't want to put something out with typos and with errors, or that isn't the best possible work that you can put out, because it's already difficult to market your own work. It's already difficult to find your readers and all the rest of it. So, I mean, I know it differs from person to person, but in general, is there like a rough estimate from between this amount to this amount that it would cost to get someone their manuscript developmentally edited, perhaps then copy edited, and a book cover? Can you speak a bit about that? Because I think it's really important that people are informed upfront and they know exactly what kind of costs they're facing so that they can budget for them.
Oh, absolutely. So what we do is I have a slew of freelance editors and designers and things like that. So when someone comes to me with their manuscript, what I do is I send it out, say they want line editing. I will send it out to our freelancers and get quotes. And then when I send that information to the author, I send it with the quote that they've given, the reason why they've given that quote. And I also give them kind of a biography of that editor so that they know that they're trustworthy, they know where to find them, things like that, and they can choose who they want to go with. Generally speaking, proofreading generally never goes over like $100. Line editing is a bit more. I would have to look in my records for that. Developmental editing is usually around $1,000, depending on how many words. It depends on the words and the sample that we're given. So if it is an error-ridden sample that is going to take a lot of work, that might cost more. So we would really have to look at the sample as well. If somebody wants to say, I really like what this person is quoting me, I like their bio, can you give me a sample edit? We will do that. We will do the first 500 words of a sample edit just to give you an idea of what we're looking at. Also with developmental editing, we'll give them a few like points that they should look for just to help them decide whether we have the right kind of voice and the right temperament that they're looking for. Because a lot of times the editor-author relationship needs to have a relationship. Do they work well together? Would they work well together? And so that's an important aspect to that. There are different, you know, I have editors who will come on strong be, you know, say, you need to change this. This should be changed. This is my suggestion. There are other editors who give, you know, you did a great job here. This is wonderful. Here are some things that I would look at. So the temperament is very important. As far as design, if somebody wants design, flat out design using, you know, stock photography, things like that, I give 3 to 6 samples for them to look at. And it generally is around $300 for that. Now, if they want a hand illustrated cover, which we do have a number of really fantastic illustrators, that can go anywhere from $1,200 to $3,000, depending on who they pick, what style they want. You know, if they want hand watercolor or if they are looking for someone doing computer aided illustration, it really depends on what the author is looking for and what their needs are.
Wonderful. Thanks for that. Yeah, I think that really helps people sort of get an understanding of, you know, what they need to budget for, what they need to look at, and all the things that they need to consider. So coming back to Wild Ink as an indie publisher, are you currently looking for manuscripts? Are you open to submissions? If not, when might that change? And what are you looking for in manuscripts?
Sure, absolutely. So right now we are quietly open, but our website says closed. That just means that if someone sends us something and we're interested in it, we are not against accepting something outside of our submission window. That is perfectly fine. All the information is still on the website for submissions. We are looking for social justice type of material. That's what I like to publish. I like to publish hard-hitting books that target a piece of society that possibly should change. So we are really targeting towards that right now. Of course, in my MFA program, I focused on YA. And so I'm always excited to get YA and middle grades books. But we have all sorts of things that we accept, from fantasy, sci-fi, historical. I especially love poetry. So yeah, we're quietly open right now. And that doesn't mean, so we're not accepting everything that comes in, but we are taking a really good look at social justice themes right now.
Wonderful. Okay, so let's talk about building an author brand even before you're published, how to do that, because that's something we get asked a lot. People are freaking out about platforms. How much of a platform do they need and how many followers do they need? So can you speak a bit about author brand and establishing that way ahead of actually going out on submission?
Absolutely. I think from the moment you start writing your book, you should start collecting a reader base in some way. Now, that doesn't mean that you necessarily have to be on social media all the time. We're all busy and, you know, authors can tend to be a little bit introverted, and so we respect that. But what I like to suggest beyond social media is taking part in writing contests, getting your work, submitting to magazines, submitting to anthologies, going to author events near your home, going to signings near your home, getting involved in the art community in your neighborhood, joining maybe a workshop, whether online or in person. These are all things that you can do to not only help your craft, but also to build a reader base. People get to know you. People notice you. I feel like books really market themselves best when word of mouth marketing is involved. And so growing a reader base by getting stories published in magazines and anthologies, that means that the readers who never thought they would stumble upon you, stumble upon you. And if they like your story, your name is going to be in their mind and they may look up, you know, your website and follow your mailing list and things like that. So it's important, like while you're writing your novel, take some moments to write some flash fiction, to write some short stories, to write some poetry, get some stuff out there into the world.
Yeah, 100% agree with all of that. And I think that, you know, people should not just view social media or author brand as a place to push themselves or push their work. I think it's really important to interact with the community, right? It's Bookstagrammers in general are wonderful in terms of promoting authors' work, and they will post about it, etc. But you need to be actively engaging with them to build a relationship. If you just slide into an Instagrammer's DMs and you're like, here's my book, please post about it,
that's not the way to do it. So really, you know, engaging with the community, letting people know what you're about, the kind of person you are, what your interests are. I think all of that is so important as well.
Yeah, I really think that, you know, especially for debut novels, readers buy the first novel because they like you. They haven't read your words yet, you know? And so you do have to. I don't like when authors only post about their books.
Yeah, Abigail, thank you so, so much for taking the time to chat with us. For our listeners, we are linking to More Than One Way to Breathe on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you get the book there, you support an independent bookstore and you support the podcast and you support Abigail at the same time. Abigail, where will they find Wild Ink Publishing? On what website, what socials, where can they find you?
Sure, it's wild-ink-publishing.com. We are also on Twitter or X, Wild Ink Pub, and we are also on Facebook and TikTok, Wild Ink Pub.
Awesome, Abigail. Thank you so, so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and CC Lira are agents at PS Litera Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and CC on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Litera Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
We couldn't be more excited to announce that the 1st and 2nd of February 2025 are the dates for the upcoming Deep Dive virtual retreat, which has reverted back to a weekend format so that we can accommodate as many of our listeners across the world as possible. Now, if you love the breakout room sessions and workshops from this year's 10-week Deep Dive, don't worry. We'll still be including sessions like those before and after the 2-day intensive. Plus, this year we're focusing on giving you access to more gatekeepers. So, besides a few awesome author presentations, expect to hear from a lot more incredible agents and editors. This lineup is spectacular. We can't wait to start sharing it with you. Mark the dates in your calendar, especially the date for the early bird pricing, which will happen on the 29th of November. You definitely don't want to miss that. Follow us on Instagram and subscribe to our newsletter for more details. We hope to see you there.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. I am so excited to share that I am teaching my super popular Hacking Writing on a Line Level class in November. And this time, it's a 3-day event. We'll spend the first 2 days learning rules and techniques that will help you elevate your writing. And then the 3rd day will be dedicated for Q&A. This class is filled with examples, and I mean it. All examples, all the time. So you will leave with an invaluable toolkit to hack your own writing on a line level. Check out the link in my bio on Instagram for more information. I hope to see you there.